And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whatever the case may be around this rotating globe. Welcome to another live edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn when tonight we cross a Rubicon. I believe it has become time for me to kind of lay out the big picture. What is at stake? And tonight's program is an installment in the future in a series of reports to our listenership all over the world who are following these astonishing developments in very rapid sequence of our discovery of several independent confirmations of ancient ET structures on the moon and Mars, etc. And parallel with this investigation, we've been looking for many years. Rob and I literally traipsed around the world measuring at sacred sites, during eclipses, this extraordinary changing background physics, which appears to modulate ultimately in the model everything. During this last eclipse, as you're going to hear tonight, we have made some additional truly remarkable observations that anybody can verify. This is open source data. Anybody can look at it and come to their own conclusions. Of course, you got to use a scientific method. And that's why David's with us tonight, David Sarita, because David, among his other multiple talents and areas of expertise, is an optician. He's a camera guy. He's a photographer. He knows optics. Well, tonight you're going to rely on optics knowledge, really, really simple, stupid, you know, optics 101. But David is our backstop in terms of expertise, because what we have discovered starts out as an extraordinary new optical phenomena recorded by multiple, countless, thousands of independent astronomers, amateur astronomers, observers, photographers, as well as all the professionals in the field at one time or another in their various careers. This is a community-wide, before a couple of weeks ago, and me looking at these images. How come nobody has reported this before? Now, there's really only two rational explanations for that, and we'll get into those as the night progresses. And I want to set this up properly because I have several important guests that will lay out the background pearls to the conclusion, the meta model, which we come to at the end of this morning's 3 hours. So you want to hang with us. You want to follow in Radio with Pictures, the imaging, the graphs, the videos. And then, of course, when the show is over, you can go back and look at all kinds of stuff to your heart's content, particularly if you're a member of Club 19.5. It's really important, guys, that you join Club 19.5. The only way we're able to do this is through the support of our subscription listeners. And the more you spread the word, the more you tell people, you want to know the truth of what's going on in this incredible, huge, multidimensional, you know, aberrant script we're all living through? Come to The Other Side of Midnight, which has pearls of wisdom and understanding to unveil. So let me start with what we don't really do here on the show, which is with the news. You'll go to theothersideofmidnight.com. You will click on tonight's banner, which says rather spectacularly, let me read it properly here so we don't get people who are first-timers, give them misinformation. Startling additional evidence from Jupiter confirming an ancient designer solar system. And we have various members of our Enterprise mission team who have independent evidence, which correlates with what I'm going to lay out tonight, as well as just people that are really incredibly involved and interested in what all this can mean. So item number one, once you get to Radio with Pictures and tonight's banner, click on that, takes you to the guest page. Item number one, that's Anthony Blinken, who is our Secretary of State. who has been performing shuttle diplomacy back and forth around the U.S., around the Middle East, trying on behalf of the U.S. to bring an end to this ghastly, awful, nightmarish, catastrophic, and on the verge of a global planetary disaster. Think of all those starving people. Unless something changes. So in the midst of this now six-month-long, half-year-long nightmare, on the 13th of April, which was just a couple, 3 weeks ago, the state of Iran launched an overwhelming fusillade of various vehicles, missiles, projectiles, drones, rockets, etc., over 350 at Israel, with a 1% error rate, which means 3.5, let's make it 4 out of the 350. Those four made it through in some fashion or another to the ground. Missiles, everything else was shot down. And that incredible accuracy of a retaliatory response against what really, if Iran had succeeded, that right there is the beginning of World War III. Israel, if you see their response to Hamas, probably if thousands of Israelis had been killed in this aerial bombardment on the 13th, the night of the 13th, would have responded with overwhelming force, and of course they have nuclear weapons, and Tehran would have become, in high likelihood, a target, which of course would have triggered other, I mean, it's a cascade of nightmarish developments that we pray will not take place, but the evidence is building both politically and in the force, in the field, in the memes of planet Earth right now, that, you know, the trend curve does not look good, which is why we need something radically different to change the conversation, which has important information, critical information for the survival of humanity itself in what is lying demonstrably now all around us in the ancient solar system. Politically has been stymied, as you've seen by the non-report to anything really, you know, substantive coming out of Washington. But the "we're surrounded by artifacts" model is totally wide open. There's nobody yelling, you know, stomping up and down saying Hoagland's crazy, because they're praying that we just go away and that no one takes our data and spreads it far and wide, which is what an internet is for. So I need to deputize every one of you tonight. Spread the word. Get people back here looking. You know, it's a measly amount to keep us going. And now, of course, is a critical time when we need every dime, because we're going to have to branch out politically to get this astonishingly important new information into the proper channels. And the only realistic way of doing that is through people, through citizens, through a democratic process, through this listenership, George's, Clyde's, and anybody else I can reach out to. Or you can reach out on our behalf. If you just tell the press, you know, there's something really amazingly cool going on over at the other side of midnight, they'll find what we're going to post. One of the things I'm going to do after this morning's show is to begin a irregular blog. And it's going to be called Captain's Blog, of course. I did this some many, many years ago, and the only problem is that it takes time away from doing other things. But in this case, the blog will be an update for our subscribers, another perk, an inside look at how this research is both scientifically coming down and politically gathering steam. And only those subscribers will be able to view this. And that's, of course, obviously, I want to entice more subscribers. But if you have an inside look at what's going on in this field of, we're surrounded by artifacts, and there are missions planned which inevitably are going to bump into them, and they will not remain hidden, not the least of which is in the next week or two, we were told weeks ago it would be May, Elon Musk is going to launch the full-up flight test of Starship for the fourth flight, the one where, if you can look at the trend curve of previous engineering and the philosophy of, you know, fly it till it breaks and then fix it and fly it again, they're probably going to have an overwhelmingly successful flight. Well, that puts us just a few flights away from Elon's sending 9 civilian tourists on a voyage around the moon. Artists who can see, who will see the dome. So that's the backdrop. We have our fate in our own hands being paced by terrestrial space companies and by NASA. On a parallel track, look at my item number 2. After this insane attack by Iran of Israel, which if it had been even 10% successful would have probably a high likelihood triggered something horrible in the Middle East, far beyond what's currently horrible. A set of videos from the Israeli Defense Force, which is item number 2. And on item number 2, just look very carefully at about, let me tell you exactly how far in. I think it's about 7 seconds in. Yeah, 7 seconds. Start looking at 7 seconds, and then you'll see something astonishing. And I can't describe it. So what we'll do is we'll go to number 3, which is 2 stills taken side by side, milliseconds apart from the video, which is number 2. The left hand is a still frame taken just at the moment of impact of some defense technology with one of Iran's missiles or drones. I think it's a cruise missile. And if you look at the rest of the video, you'll see what high energy explosives do to a drone or a missile. You know, it's basically catch and kill. It blows up. There's a big, you know, light field of circular light, you know, and overwhelming the camera, and that's an explosion. That's a high energy, high explosives. This video, beginning at 7 seconds, as part of this 3 or 4 video montage released by Israel, shows something radically, totally, weirdly different. Because the, quote, explosion is not an explosion, but it's the multiple appearance of nested shells of hyper-dimensional hexagonal geometry. At the image on the left, image on the right, taken about a second or two later, is when this incredibly geometric whatever in the you know, a field is collapsing, and it releases the target, the drone that Iran was sending toward Israel. It's not destroyed. It's not exploded. It's not fragmented. It has been made inert and is falling under gravity helplessly to smash into the ground. The various professional analyses, and there's one particular guy, I forget his name, at MIT, who was a professor of military analysis and intelligence analysis. He's published a very thoughtful paper basically saying that what Israel did the night of the 13th was not possible. And from that, he concludes that the damage from Iran was far more than Israel has admitted to. Unfortunately, if that was true, then our U.S. satellite technology would pick it up and it would become, you know, part of the president's daily brief, and there would be a, you know, tumult by wire reporters and other reporters for the truth. And our guys would have to tell the truth because, you know, the Biden presidency is riding on what's going on in the Middle East. Just look at the campus demonstrations. So when you look at that image, number 3, stills from this intercept Iran missile Israeli video, it looks incredibly eerie, like the super stupendous event that took out Tonga. Remember the cubical explosion, the so-called underwater volcano? Yeah, right. No, this was a hyper-dimensional torsion field weapon deployed by Israel, maybe, or an Israeli ally, also maybe, or a really far out Israeli ally, think upstairs, think UAP, think sides in a much bigger war, because if Iran has succeeded, we would not be having this conversation tonight. And that's not, it's not just a rational left brain analysis. It's a right brain analysis and folks plugged into higher sources of information, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The extinction of the human race was meant to start last April 13th, that night. And it did not. Now, why didn't it? Is it wiser heads? Is it better defenses? Is it secret layers of defenses? Is it hyperdimensional physics? Because whoever put out the video obviously hadn't a clue and didn't know, look, you're not supposed to show that set of frames. I mean, look at that astonishing non-explosive geometry. Explosions do not have geometry, which leads us directly into item number 4. The reason we're here tonight is because following the April 8th eclipse of the sun by the moon, for the last time in a generation for the United States, for the second time only in 7 years since 2017, the last one that Rob and I were able to measure, we had an eclipse across the country, and it engendered a tremendous amount of interest among the, you know, civilian population. And, of course, at NASA and other government agencies. Millions of people along that shadow line, which is the map in number 4, were able to see with their own eyeballs an astonishing event. Now, I'm going to get to, in a few minutes, some more data showing that, in fact, this eclipse helped cement the idea there is this incredible ancient glass dome in incredibly fractured and eroded condition around the moon. I present to the court item number 5, because that is a eclipse that was taken, I'm not quite sure when this was taken because the print is a little bit too small. Okay, this is from 1998, an eclipse taken in the Far East with film, ISO, very fast film, 120. And what you see is the dome, that glass-looking bright ring around the dark moon with the corona outside and the dark of the night side of the moon facing Earth within the dark ring, that bright ring is, that's the dome. That's everything I have been saying for the last several decades. Now, the proof of this in this one image is look at what I've itemized at the top of the image near the north pole of the sun. It's called a polar coronal streamer. It's because the inner corona of the sun is electrons, and the sun has a very powerful magnetic field, and it constrains electrons to move in certain ways and not in other ways, and that causes geometry and dense parts, streams, and vacuous parts where the vacuum is much higher. In other words, it's a bunch of folk magnetic field lines impressed in a constantly moving, incredibly high temperature, million degree solar corona of electrons primarily. But if you look at my inset in the upper right, on this frame, you'll see that the ring, the bright ring, which everybody for literally hundreds of years since we've had telescopes have interpreted as the corona right above the sun, the inner corona. It's not. It's the dome. Now, the reason we know this is because look at my inset. Look at the arrow. Look at what's happening. The glass that's refracting, bending light from the brilliant solar disk, the photosphere, around the moon so we can see it, is passing in front of, by 93 million miles, that dark streamer, which is interrupted at 90 degrees by something bright and refracting in front of it. Clearly, we're looking at two separate phenomena separated by the distance between the moon and the sun, which is 93 million miles beyond. And that one image is all you need to know if you understand the physics. And yet it has been seen by literally millions of people first with, you know, naked eye, because you can't really make out the detail we're seeing in this photograph with the naked eye. So all naked eye observations can be excused for thinking this incredible, brilliant ring is in fact the corona, the beginning of the corona. It's not. It's a dome around the moon, a glass shell, like wrapping the moon in saran wrap, layer after layer after layer. And the dome is about 20 miles high. So as we're going to talk about later tonight, that has extraordinary, impossible implications for what has been going on for the last several hundred years. Now, number six is a photograph I showed last week. And when we get past this introduction, we're going to go to Holger, because Holger is going to describe what's seen in this picture. Contrary to previously published NASA information, and I found another source tonight, the Smithsonian, for some reason, knowing for years that the International Space Station would be flying right through the path of totalities, right through the cone above that dark circle in image number six, at the last minute, NASA missed. They didn't hit the shadow. They went past it at the edge. They didn't get really into totality. They got like about an 85% eclipse. And the reason is, well, that's one of the things we're going to talk about tonight. Item number seven is a comparison from a NOAA GEO satellite, 22,300 miles up, of the central part of the eclipse on the left, that's the full disk image, and the Isis image on the right, that's from a steep angle to the south as it was approaching, I think it was just leaving Texas when that image was taken. And then what we do is, because I got so intrigued with the fact that contrary to all normal known optical physics, I mean, if I have a body the size of the moon, 2,000 miles across, and it's a little under 250,000 miles away from the Earth, 240,000 miles, and I've got sunlight coming past it to hitting the Earth during certain phases of the Earth and the moon's orbit when the moon's shadow can cross the Earth, because the moon is tilted to the Earth's tilted orbit. When all that, you know, gets together, coalesces, you get an eclipse. Now, they're in different places all over the Earth, you know, every give or take 18 months. Some years have two, some years have, anyway. So it's irregularly regular. Items 8A and 8B is a set of images taken from the GOES satellite system of a total solar eclipse separated by a couple of years in the 2000s that crossed the South Pole, the ice cap, and the North Pole, the polar ices of the Arctic Sea. Now, when you click on those, you're going to see something really absolutely bizarrely, weirdly amazing. Shape of the shadow of the moon is not a circle or even a lopsided ellipse-like circle. It is a geometric, straight-sided figure. And we'll get into this in a little more detail very shortly. Item number nine shows what I think is going on, because the moon is acting like a lens, given that 20-mile-high, you know, dome circling it. So any sunlight going past the edge of the moon will be bent. And that's why in those images above, you see this greatly reddened area of the clouds around the dark black center of the eclipse. That is due to the differential refraction by the lens of the dome on the clouds of the Earth. And it's something that I, as I said a few weeks ago, you know, like Spock in Star Trek, I feel so dumb. I feel like a fool. I should have figured this out a long time ago. Well, if that's what's going on, then number 10 also is going on, because the recent mission to the moon, the Intuitive Machine unmanned Odysseus spacecraft, on the way down with wide-angle cameras, took pictures of the dome as it was literally landing on the moon, including based image taken about 1,000 feet up. The Earth, 2 degrees wide, seen not far from the sun, through the dome, in an incredibly distorted fashion, incredibly old as we calculate, is not like it was when it was new. It's got incredible imperfections. It's got all kinds of wavy distortions. It's behaving like any wavy glass, even though it's wrapped around the moon. And through the dome, when you look at the Earth or photograph it, that's what you get, number 10. Number 11 is some videos put out by a guy named Crow777 of a surface wave phenomenon. In number 12, I've got some still shots showing the progression of these optical waves in the lunar dome. If they're physical, they're moving at 200 miles per second. I think they're optical, meaning some kind of control mechanism, piezoelectrics, whatever, is rotating portions of the dome, changing its refraction, changing the refractional light beaming in certain directions, causing the illusion of a shockwave when in fact it's all just synchronized timing of a controllable, intelligent, smart architecture dome. Very, very old. Number 13, now this is where things get absolutely radically bizarre. I started thinking about the outer solar system, and I remembered that when I looked at one of the engineering releases a year or two ago from Webb, that there was something really bizarre about the shadow of Europa. I mean, look at number 13. Look at left-hand wide angle. Then look at number 13 right. That's the shadow of Europa? That's bizarre, because look at 14. Then look at 15. 15 is a comparison of 14, an eclipse of the moon's geometric shadow over the Earth, and Europa's image from Webb showing an incredibly identical hexagonal geometric shadow of Europa. What the hell is going on here? Well, for that, I think we want to go and start with Holger Eisenberg. Let me check my time here. Actually, no, we don't have enough time. We're literally at the bottom of the hour. So when we come back, I'm going to be calling on Holger, who has been looking into what has happened with NASA and the terrestrial eclipse. And if Keith's been able to mount my last item, you're going to find that this is not new. This is a pattern with NASA and eclipses. It's almost like they're afraid. Now, would that be true? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. supports a broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on the other side of midnight for this Sunday night, May 5th. It's some anniversary. It's the 24th anniversary of something that was really interesting that went on in Phoenix, Arizona 24 years ago. And I've been trying to remember what it is that brought Robin and me to Phoenix on the 24th anniversary, literally tonight. And I can't remember. So put that aside, and we'll see if we are on track. So when I look at all this data, I'm absolutely flabbergasted that after all the hype, NASA did not fly the International Space Station through the eclipse. So to background us on this, Holger Eisenberg, who is a systems operation and consulting expert around Java-based enterprise applications since the late 90s in Germany, moved in 2016 to Silicon Valley and is solving customer problems at companies specializing in providing high-performance Java VNS. In his spare time, he is applying software engineering skills on the public data provided by various NASA missions. And there's a whole bunch more if you want to go to the the Other Side of Midnight website and look on at his bio. You'll get a really interesting background. Holger is a multidisciplinary engineer. And Holger, you found the other day something which got me really intrigued. And together, I think we have confirmed another NASA weirdness about eclipses. Go for it.
It was a great eclipse surprise, and I got to that while actually observing the totality of the eclipse. I was lucky to be able to, because I'm living in California, and here it was only a partial eclipse, but I had the opportunity to visit a friend who is living in Arkansas on the 200-kilometer band of the totality shadow. That was a good opportunity I had there.
Okay, so what did you
and that triggered and thinking about it, because before the eclipse I was planning for the trip and was busy with that and didn't look up much about NASA and what was planned there. But when I was there, then finally a few days before on the weekend, we went to a nearby city near Little Rock. It was Russellville. And in Russellville, a small town of maybe 20,000 citizens, NASA had a big event, an official NASA event there on the town center, with a big NASA delegation of several people, live streaming, a large audience from the locals there, several hundred people sitting there on the lawn outside, and big advertising by NASA, there are 3D letters there, a large stage, and presenters ongoing, delegation from France, from the Paris Observatory, from the French Lasia Institute there, famous institute.
Well, look, did you actually see totality?
Not from there, but I saw it in, from near Little Rock there on Monday. After the event, the Russellville event was starting already.
Ah, okay. So that was like
that was basically
a festival leading up.
Yeah, NASA was staying there during the eclipse. Also,
so what did the eclipse
to the audience?
Holger, You're burying the lead. What does the eclipse look like to you?
That was also one reason to be there, because I saw one.
Oh, my God. He's like Spock. He's like Spock. Talk about what it felt like to see the eclipse. Come on.
Yeah, 25 years ago, I was viewing one in Germany, 1999. Totally.
Very, very famous eclipse, yes.
Yeah, and that was indeed special, because I only saw it before, of course, on photos. And then I was lucky with the German overcast weather to see it for a few seconds.
Yeah, but wait. You're not the same guy you were in 1999. Forget 99.
No.
Talk about what saw.
I wanted to see it without clouds in Arkansas, and I was lucky to have a clear sky in that state. And it was an amazing experience. I can recommend to everyone. Yeah, we went to a nature area in a forest area, a small village.
Did you have optical aid? Did you have a telescope, binoculars?
Yeah, I brought my 80 by 18 binoculars, really large ones.
Right.
Of course, you have to be careful not to use them during the day, only during the totality.
Yeah. Well, that light drop off between the last speck of the photosphere and the corona, that's a factor of a million.
Yeah, it went from almost normal daylight to dusk.
Yeah, and your eyes don't adapt that rapidly. So people in my model have been looking at this damn dome. I'll bet you didn't notice it.
No.
See, look at item number five. Look at my photo number five. With a decent pair of binoculars, it should have been brilliantly glaring to you and everybody else, because AP photographed it and published a gorgeous picture, even showing the geometry in it. But see, everybody has thought that ring was the corona. And as long as you are marking up the wrong eclipse, that's the corona, you'll never get the right model for what it really is. Because who in their right mind would imagine a dome, a 15 million square mile dome covering our damn moon? It's our moon. Who had the right to build a damn dome there? At least that's the way I think people subliminally feel. So when you went looking, it didn't even cross your mind to try to see the dome?
Yeah, when it was dark for the 4 minutes of totality, when you take off the solar eclipse glasses, then the sky was dark blue, like on dusk, and especially obvious was a glaring white, sharp white chromosphere ring around the moon.
Wait, what color?
It was white.
It's not white.
Yeah,
Holger, it's fine. Not white. You should expect the chromosphere is brilliant red pink because of the hydrogen.
It's called
the chromosphere because of the red color you saw was the dome.
It was, because in 1999, I completely remember, especially seeing a violet or purple half ring. That was
strange. Okay, that's the chromosphere, and the reason it's a violet is because the hydrogen atom, which is doing the radiating in the chromosphere, has a brilliant red line, a blue line, and a violet line, and together they produce kind of a violetish red, which is pink, kind of brilliant luminous pink. That's the chromosphere.
Yeah.
What you saw in white was the refraction in the dome of the photosphere, which is, again, almost a million times brighter right below it.
Yeah, to explain to the viewers, I saw, because I was expecting to see this violet purple ring I saw in Germany, but I could not see it directly. What I saw was a really bright, extremely bright and sharp. That was surprising. I was not expecting this sharpness of the thin ring. I was expecting a more blurry, like in view 4-5. It was really high contrast, sharp white.
Did you look at it with binoculars or a telescope?
Yeah, then I looked through the binoculars, because that you can do during totality. And then I saw the purple protuberance on the lower right corner, like in the 4-5, in your item 5, that was invisible. And then I saw it also with with the bare eye afterwards, after the adaption of the eye. You could also see the purple part on the lower right with the bare eye, even the small dot, the prominent protuberance on the lower right. But all else was brilliantly white, except for this small spot cell. That was surprising. And during the...
Well, that small spot, which was kind of on the bottom right, that was a prominence from the...
That was prominent, only that was purple-violet.
Yeah, well, that's because it was sticking up. It was sticking up optically beyond the edge of the dome on the moon. Anyway, let's move on.
Then to unfold over the corona, I could see through the binocular. That was surprising that I could actually see it, and I could see the structures like in the item 5. See those parallels in fine structures that I could see with my eyes through the binocular. That was surprising. I wasn't expecting that, but I could see it. It was really nice.
Okay, let's talk about NASA and the eclipse, because as you'll see at the end of the Smithsonian article that Keith has posted, which is my last item, I think it's item number 25, NASA before the eclipse was telling everybody, including its own astronauts, it was going to fly through the totality. And the reason that they could do that is because it doesn't take very much rocket power, you know, from the Russian module or from one of the docked spacecraft, either the Dragon or Soyuz, to, with a few rocket firings of their onboard thrusters, you raise the orbit, or you lower the orbit, actually you always raise it, of the space station so that you can adjust the timing of the orbit. So if you know next Monday there's going to be an eclipse, like on Friday, you can do your adjustments with very minimal, you know, rocket fuel, a few pounds, and Monday you'll fly right through the center. Well, instead of doing that, NASA this time for the April 8th eclipse did burns to avoid flying through the shadow. Holger, what do you think?
That's, and they not only avoided it, they adjusted the flight in that way that they barely scraped it. That they just went outside, but not inside the shadow. So they really perfectly timed it somehow. And afterwards I checked it in detail. The normal orbit boost they do every month. They do it every 2 to 4 weeks. And that is 5 kilometer altitude gain. And with the 5 kilometer altitude gain, they get about 6 seconds orbit duration extension. That means to the 90-minute orbit duration, the normally 6 seconds.
Oh, if they wanted to fly right through it, it was trivial, and they didn't. So this is my bigger question. Have you figured out yet why NASA does not, under pain of death, want to fly the space station through totality of an eclipse?
I tried to find out in public forums.
Sorry.
And... my first guess was, first I saw the live stream also, the recording of the live stream, and another commentary there in the official NASA live stream said, oh, the eclipse, the ISS crew has advantage towards us on Earth, that they can see the eclipse twice. They can see it in the sky.
Yeah, looking up and looking down.
And they can see the shadow on the ground, but the commentary was obviously forgetting that the crew cannot.
Well, here's a piece of data.
The crew cannot look up. The crew doesn't have.
Yes, they can. Of course they can.
No, they don't. They have windows, but the windows are closed from the outside. So to open the windows shutters, those window shutters, they have to do an EVA for those window shutters, because it is not a large nadir window towards Earth. But they can open from the inside. Those are special.
Then how come on live television they were saying, yes, we're going to look up and take photographs, and they showed the astronaut and all these cameras and his long focus gear and everything? So obviously they've got some kind of optical port that looks up.
But no, they don't have.
Then how could we say they were going to photograph the eclipse looking up?
I don't know.
It's either a lie or you don't know every port on the space station.
And that you... you would imagine that they have at least an automatic outside camera pointing up. That would be no big deal because they have at least 10 cameras pointing down.
Well, see, everything about this is not a civilian space program. NASA is a cover for the military. So if you think you know every window they've got, you don't. So we stop there. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, about the avoidance, because I checked exactly how much they avoided it. On my item number 3, you can see the ISS ground tricks, orange line there, and the eclipse shadow path on Earth. Those are the elliptic black spots there. Each spot is at a certain time in minute distance here. I added the time in UTC there. For each minute, the shadow moves on Earth a bit, and the ISS ocean moves from the lower, from the upper left to the lower right. And you see that both are crossing, actually. So they had the chance to fly through the shadow, but they missed by about 15 to 30 seconds.
And your conclusion is?
That was controlled.
Exactly. So here's, now by the way, did you look at the times of their closest approach?
Yeah, it was, the ISS was
19.5.
Yeah, okay. 19,
look at that.
1932.
No, that's
19.5.
Yeah,
9 and a half. Yeah.
No, that's an accident. Come on. You know nothing about this agency is straight. Anyway, so they've been avoiding eclipses. Why?
Hang on.
Answer the question. They've been obviously avoiding eclipses. I know this going back to 1966, after one manned spacecraft, a Gemini, deliberately flew through a total eclipse shadow. NASA has avoided, with every other manned mission, any movement through the shadow during an eclipse. That's over almost 60 years. Why?
On that Gemini mission, I guess one person is still alive who could tell.
Yeah, Aldrin.
Aldrin saw it.
Yeah.
Or not. I don't know.
Well, remember, they altered his mind when he walked on the moon, so who the hell knows what they... All right, we can back-engineer this. Why would you not, after one manned spacecraft flew through the shadow, why would you avoid the shadow?
If I was responsible for the ISS, I would... the risk would be, if you fly through it, you suddenly fly through a location of... more than half the electron density in the ionosphere. That is dropping to about half the electron density.
Right.
But you have the same effect also if you fly from the day side to the night side on Earth. It is the same drop.
So that should not be an issue. Lowering levels are not an issue.
So the absolute numbers are the same. Only difference is that you only have it for those 30 seconds, because 30 seconds the ISS is flying through the shadow, so it's a shorter time you have this change, but it is not more extreme than flying into the night side. But that would be my only concern then.
Yeah, given the mass of the space station, it can't even react in 30 seconds to a temperature change of not being in sunlight. Or it even knows it's not in sunlight, it's in sunlight again. No. These are all hokey explanations. The real explanation is obviously hyperdimensional physics. There are so many rotating systems on ISIS that it would kill the space station. It would endanger their lives. And how do I know that? You go back to my items and look at my item number 24. Those were actual measurements that I took with Robin on the top of the Sandia Mountain here in 2012, showing the effect of an annular eclipse on the regular inertial vibrations of an Ankatron tuning fork. Remember, the key motto of hyperdimensional physics is rotation, rotation, rotation. So think of all the rotating systems on ISIS, from the gyros that maintain the attitude to the various computer systems to the experiments to spacecraft navigation. In other words, everything would go crazy based on what you see in item number 24. And that's why They cannot tell us the truth. They dare not go through the eclipse because it would so destroy ISIS in terms of electronics and control. And so they come out with lies.
Yeah, I'm also aware about those pendulum experiments during totality eclipse.
Oh, Marie Soleil, yeah.
Showed, indeed, some showed interesting results. They showed definitely changes. And then the discussion was it only a change due to the sudden temperature drop, maybe? That is still unexplained. No, so, not that level.
No, because Soleil's experiment in 1954 in Paris was in a sealed basement laboratory. Again, they didn't even know in the laboratory there was an eclipse going on upstairs. But the pendulum at the beginning of the eclipse showed dramatic excursions that mirror in sign exactly my Akachon readings and other measurements by other means during eclipses by other experimenters. So it's obvious they're avoiding the physics. Now, that brings us back to my items. Let me get the number here. 14. Or 14 and 50. Because what, Hoger, could possibly cause a geometric shadow around a total solar eclipse on the Earth?
I don't see the geometric shadow, but what I saw on the ground when I was watching it...
Wait. When you look at 14, what don't you see?
I see the reddish, strange-shaped...
And then you see a gray area.
Umbra.
Outside that, right. And then it goes orange. And that those are all straight lines. That's not a circle. That's geometry. It's hexagonal geometry because you're looking at the horizon. It's cutting the hexagon almost in two. And the full hexagon is visible in 13 on the right-hand side. What would cause this geometry in an optical shadow from an eclipse past an airless world?
Yeah, without atmosphere, that is strange to explain, because hexagons, you see...
Holger, you can't get away with saying it's strange to explain. Why is it strange?
We see hexagons on Saturn in the water.
This is a shadow. This is not in the Earth's atmosphere. This is a projection, a shadow, a trick of light and shadow. Why is it geometric? It's a crucial question to understanding the physics of what you're seeing.
I was when I looked at the eclipse on the ground shortly before the totality, you can see an effect on the ground like you are underwater.
Yeah, and it's called shadow band.
Underwater.
Called shadow band. That's the shimmering of the refractions in the glass around the moon.
Yeah, I could not precisely see it because I was on a lawn, and but if you are on a flat surface, I could even see it on the lawn, on the grass there. It looked like the grass was moving, but actually it was a...
Well, what you need to do is you need to put down a white bed sheet.
Yeah, I didn't have that. You know, only at a nice nature area there. But
always that
is also a bit strange effect to explain. It is explained by atmospheric density change.
No. This is why this is getting incredibly important.
Yeah, I know. It's not completely explained. Yeah,
it's not explained at all. God, you act like one of the journals. There's no possible rational, normal explanation for that. There is in the hyperdimensional physics model, because in that model, based on the observational data we've accrued over many years now, including specifically those shockwave measurements, you know, 11 and 12, the dome is not a passive, you know, dome of glass. It's active. It's alive. It's electrical. If somebody's turned it on, and what it does when the sunlight goes past the moon, it is differentially refracted into that geometry. This is no small advance in physics. This is impossible by any normal optics.
Okay, but what I cannot explain is after 2 minutes when the eclipse, when the totality started at my location, I heard a loud boom sound, like an explosion, like a sonic boom. Well, directly in the middle of the
All right, that actually could have been a sonic boom. I'd have to go look. But NASA was flying two RB-47, which is, it used to be a bomber. It's now a reconnaissance high-speed aircraft. And they fly at supersonic along the shadow to prolong the eclipse. So you could have heard the shockwave, the sonic boom from the NASA aircraft that was somewhere close to your site, because I think that's where the eclipse would have been longest. So they got the biggest shadow, so they got the most time.
Yeah, that was indeed in the center, in the middle in the Arkansas. That was we had 4 minutes there. That was the maximum.
So anyway, I'm proposing that it's the activation of the dome that changed the geometry of the shadow, because it can manipulate, among other things, light. Remember some weeks ago when Nova Spivak, the guy who's landed my book twice on the moon now as part of the archive, remember when he asked me that night, you know, well, why would somebody have built a dome around the moon? Which, is, of course, is the most important question, crucial question. And we really don't have an answer yet. But if you can see that that structure, that artificial structure, is so radically unlike a, you know, a circular or elliptical shadow from a dead vacuum, you know, graced world, which is what the moon's supposed to be. And then you get the same sign of geometry by a shadow cast from the sun on Jupiter from Europa. Well, that leads me to item number 16, which of course is a close up from the latest Juno flyby of Europa, showing that its surface is covered with incredible geometric artificial glass structures, architecture, buildings, transport, rails, geometry. It's just, it's astonishing. And so it's not a surprise that its shadow would be brilliantly illuminated. The real surprise, of course, is the geometry. What does that mean? Pose the activation of these domes interacts with light in such a way as to recreate a shadow of the hyperdimensional geometry that's being used. In other words, with passive objects, you wouldn't get this effect. You only get it with objects where somehow within the moon or within the dome around the moon, either Luna or Europa, there's an active, incredibly advanced super technology which is showing us what, in fact, we're seeing around the moon. Okay, we're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning so far has been Holger Eisenberg. We're going to be joined by others when we take the break at the top of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard Z. Hoagland, and we shall return. Don't touch that dial.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Why should I be afraid to die? There's no reason for it, but it is
sometimes. And welcome back on this Sunday night, May 5th. 2024. My guests this morning are kind of too numerous to mention, so we'll get to the next one. Hoger will stand by. I mean, that's an amazing discovery that going back independently 60-some years to that first eclipse that NASA tried to look at with the manned Gemini spacecraft, and forevermore they never looked again. What did they see? What kind of readings? What happened to all the control systems? Did they almost lose the astronauts till they declassify this stuff? We'll never know. Okay, Ruggiero, are you available?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning.
Well, I want to introduce Ruggiero as a full-fledged member of the Enterprise Mission Team. Because within hours of each other, we had both identified on the new super close-up images from Juno of the inner Galilean satellite orbiting Jupiter called Io, something really bizarre. And if I'd been a little quicker, I would have seen it first, but Ruggiero saw it first. And then he said in an email, "What the hell is this?" And I looked and I said, well, obviously you have made history. So start at the beginning, Ruggiero. What made you look carefully the Juno images, Gesundheit, at the Juno images of Io? And what did you find?
Well, should we go all the way back?
Right, yes. By all means, yes.
Why I got into this journey in the first place.
Okay.
So it starts when I was... age 7, was in an assembly at school, and I went to a Catholic primary school, and I was given, we were given this lecture about the building of the pyramids of Egypt, and I remember they had like a display screen up, and they were showing the slaves pulling the pyramid blocks across the sand on wooden rollers, and I was like, that doesn't add up. He couldn't do that. Those blocks would sink into the sand. It's just not going to happen. So my little mind at the time was trying to do a load of maths. How could you actually do that with those rollers? It doesn't make any sense. And at that point, it started my journey in the discovery of ancient history. And
how old were you at the time?
7.
Ah. Yeah, it's amazing. The epiphany comes very early sometime.
Yeah. So then, you know, fast forward a few years, I got into reading at university. I was given a book by a friend's father. And it was by Alan Wolford. Are you aware of him?
No.
He was one of the, I guess, pioneers in the alternative, looking at... how our ancient structures on this planet were built, and the fact that they're spread all over the place. You know, we've got Egypt, we've got Mexico, Teotihuacan, all the pyramids of South America, China, Tenerife, the list goes on. And he beautifully put together in this, eloquently in this book, how he thought the structures were linked and the incredible ways that they were built. As well, some of the construction techniques. I got a book by Graham Hancock as well, who outlined, you know, the 19.5 that's in some of his work as well. Further reading, going into a guest, I've got his name, Brian Forrester, which you need to have on your show. Brian outlines the building processes of these pyramidal structures like nobody else has. And what he specifically points out is how our historians say the advanced structures, the structures which are oldest are the most advanced, and then for some reason they would build rubble type structures on top, and that didn't make any sense. And his work has just captivated me even more, and it's led me on to how we eventually get to where we are today. Obviously everyone is aware, or if they're not aware, I drew the bone feature. I have an eye for detail. I'm dyslexic. I think that forced me when I was younger to really work hard at studying my science, and in my day job I have to constantly look at detail when I'm working with my clients. I think that's given me an eye that allows me to perhaps look at things in a different way that other people don't, which brings me on to how did I get to looking at image number one? Well, on my Monday mornings, I normally check on my laptop. Oh, what's last doing today? And that timing feature where I beat you to it, Richard. I clicked on UK time, half past 8, 9 o'clock, or just before 9, to the NASA website, and lo and behold, this fantastic image of Io on the Juno mission popped up, and I just looked straight into the center. I saw this line bisecting the moon, and in the middle of the line, right at the center, I was like, what the hell is that? And there is, if everyone clicks onto my image number one, there is this feature that jumps out. Now, when you look at it, Richard, what do you see?
You mean that image in the center of Io?
Yeah.
It's a collection of buildings on a mesa. It's obvious.
Yeah, it is to us. It is to us.
Well, it's obvious to any reasonable human being. The reason that NASA people don't spill the beans is either they've been bought off. That's Andrew and my, favorite model. Because if they're told they get a piece of the action and all they have to do is keep their mouth shut, doesn't matter how many striking, stunning architectural things you see in the images, if you don't say anything, we live in a culture where nobody covers anything. They're waiting for mama or daddy to give them permission. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I've even before we've launched this, I've told people what I was found about. I've said to a few close people I know, I said, hey, look at this. Just get my laptop out. What's that? They're like, well, I don't know. What do you think it is? Well, it looks like a structure. So, yeah. And
what happens when you tell them where it is?
They just have a deadpan, glazed face, look over their face, and it's like, does not compute.
And exactly. It's like, Andrew, are you with us? Andrew? I guess he's not with us. Okay. Andrew is a psychologist in one of his degrees, so I wanted to ask him about the psychology. I think, frankly, Ruggiero, it's because if you take any of this stuff as real, everything has to change.
Absolutely. Like you say, if NASA emit one micro.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you. Because when I get to the Jovian part toward the end of the show, wait till you see what else these amateur astronomers have been missing.
Yeah, I can't wait. This has been a fantastic show. Listen to you and Holger.
Oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. Yeah. Well, all right. Holger, would you agree that I have a working hypothesis that, NASA's first rule is thou shalt not fly complex manned spacecraft through the Earth's shadow of an eclipse?
They should do. They should look up.
Good. Can you imagine?
They're not looking up.
Can you imagine what a 14-inch celestron in a vacuum would do with the right magnification, let's say 1,000 or 2,000, with zero atmosphere, and they could take electronic images of the details of the dome as the moon slid across the last sliver of the photosphere, and the light plunges by a factor of a million. And I've got some images. I have a huge number of images that I've quietly amassed on this subject, showing the detailed structure of the dome from Earth. Well, imagine if you could see the level of detail in a vacuum with a good telescope looking up from Isis at a total eclipse, if you would dare to fly through the shadow. Those measurements, go back and look at my, item number 24, yeah. That shows you don't dare. Physics is going to kill the spacecraft.
I agree. It would look spectacular, especially with my $200 binocular. I could see amazing details through the atmosphere, and I could see the parallel strings in the corona by Thomson scattering.
All right, hang on. I want to segue from your amazing artificial discovery, which is on a place, by the way, that I would not have expected to see something like this. Do you know why? All the volcanic activity.
Okay,
if we're looking at ancient structures, they should have been buried in thousands of feet of sulfur particles, dust particles, tephra, what spews out of volcanoes, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as a very, very, very dry snowfall. So why are these structures still visible?
No idea.
Well, think about it logically. If you're dealing with objects in the solar system, the presumption is we're looking at processes that have gone on for billions of years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Suppose the volcanism of Io is not billions of years old, but is less than 100 million.
Okay.
Suppose Io and other phenomena we observe is not natural at all, but is part of this super designer solar system. And after you have a major war in your designer solar system, things are not quite working right. And so something radically went wrong with Io and Europa and Ganymede, and they created this resonance triumvirate that moves the orbits in resonance with the tidal locking of Jupiter. So the migration of energy, tidal energy from Jupiter into the moons, which is what's keeping the oceans of Europa liquid and keeping the ocean in Ganymede liquid and keeping the sulfurous magmas beneath the surface of Io liquid. It's not primordial. It started yesterday. So we're looking at time. There hasn't been time for the tephras to bury the stunning artificial structures in the Terminator region in the center of Io that you found on the Juno images, several cousin
Thank
of
you,
your
Richard.
Eye. Because
Thank
you see geometry, and you know it can't be a damn volcano. So.
And there's something very bizarre, which is, I've highlighted through my image, my features. If everyone clicks onto image number two.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's let everybody look at these. Let's let them look at them on their own, because we got a lot more show to get to. And if we go through every image, we'll be here till tomorrow at 6 a.m. So we can't do that. So everybody take the time and go through the images. And when we touch on this again, we'll have Ruggiero back and he'll discuss any details that you might have questions about. The one thing I want to call your attention to, Ruggiero, look at number one and look at the bottom of the globe, the bottom of the disk. What do you see?
Very bottom.
Yeah,
well,
very bottom. Curving all around the limb of Io.
Oh, I think I found that a few weeks back. There's like a cloudy circular structure.
It's the Ionian atmosphere.
Right.
Because remember, when you've got a planet, and Io is bigger than the moon, belching out dozens of volcanoes 24/7. All those gases have to go somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And they don't go into space because Io has a significant gravity field. So they hang around as an atmosphere which is waxing and waning, depending upon the cyclic behavior of the volcanoes, right? More volcanoes, more stuff in the atmosphere than the radiation belt to the magnetosphere of Jupiter whip it away. And then you have another cycle of volcanoes, and you've got more stuff accumulating in the atmosphere. Well, would you believe that on Jupiter, 250-some thousand miles away, I believe, you can see in the shadows of Io the actual refraction through the atmosphere of the gases wrapped around Io. And I think I can show you that in an image. No, I don't have it. Okay, but I really could do that, but I can't do it tonight because I didn't pick that image. So, let me see. Where are we going to go next? I think I want to go back to the eclipse shadows because it's going to tie in with what you found on Io very nicely, very shortly. Okay.
Okay. I'll wait patiently.
Let me check the time. It's 17 after. And I want everyone to go to item number 17, because my next question after image 15 and my image 14 and the other images of the Earth in the shadow of the moon, our own moon, that did not look like shadows should look at all. Come on, they should be circles, not geometry, come on, that does not happen naturally. Unless there is a physics going on, which we are not privy to. So take a look at 17, click on it, it takes you to a bigger version. This is an official image of Ganymede, which is the round moon in front to the left of Jupiter, crossing, transiting Jupiter behind it by about, 660,000 miles is the distance of Ganymede from Jupiter. And the dark circle on Jupiter, right at the bottom where the pole would be, that's the shadow projected onto Jupiter. Now, this was taken in the 1940s or 1950s by a telescope on Mount Wilson. We think it was the 60-inch. It could have been the 100-inch. But what you want to look at is the shadow of Ganymede. Do you see ring around the shadow of Ganymede, or around Ganymede itself to the left?
But there's a fuzzy haze around the shadow in the middle, and it's almost like it's eight-sided.
Eight-sided to me. Okay, so you see something there, okay. Then let's look at number 18. Click on 18.
This is
an amateur taken on the 7th day, that's 7th month rather, that's July 17th, of 2020 of a transit of Ganymede across Jupiter. And you can see the satellite, you can see the shadow, and you can see the bright rings around both. Blatant. And unfortunately, this guy did not use his name on the internet, so I can't credit him properly. But yeah, I guarantee you there are thousands of amateur images taken all over the world looking at the transits of the satellites of Jupiter and their shadows. And most of them, 99%, show bright rings around the moon and the shadow. So what's going on? Take a look at number 19, right? Number 19. Number 19, Cassini image taken when the Cassini spacecraft flew by Jupiter on the way to Saturn. Look at the left-hand image, that's the raw. Look at the right-hand image, that's the enhanced. What do you see around Ganymede?
On the right-hand one, there's a clear, glowing
shadow.
Shadow.
That shouldn't be there. That's impossible. That cannot exist in a NASA universe. No, 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 as Michael Cohen said. But there's the dome, and why are we seeing it glowing? You realize why? Think of it as a giant 3,000-mile-wide lens. What do lenses do?
They refract and they bend light.
Of the things behind them. What is behind Ganymede in this picture?
Well, Jupiter.
Yes. So the bright ring is the 3,000-mile-wide image of a Galilean moon-sized telescope seen by the spacecraft flying about 1 million miles further away as it went past Jupiter heading for Saturn. There's a damn dome. Changes everything. Because we now have multiple geometries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Multiple lighting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Multiple spacecraft, right?
Yeah.
Multiple viewing angles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any doubt in your mind there's a damn dome around Ganymede?
Well, not really, because a few weeks back, Bridget, we didn't get to cover it on the show. I did some little enhanced segments of that dust cloud, we could call it,
mm-hmm.
and within it is 3D, like we see on the moon, there's 3D latticing through that wispy cloud. Oh, sorry, we're talking different structure. Sorry, I go back, so I confuse myself. Because on Io, you've got the dust from the volcanoes, which looks the same, but
what you obviously need to do is. We know there are volcanoes on Io, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's not even an atmosphere measured around Ganymede. It's a vacuum. It's zero.
Yeah.
And there's a vacuum supposedly around Europa. The only Galilean moon with volcanoes creating an atmosphere is Io. And that's what we see in the shadow. You'll see the refraction of the sunlight through the upper levels of that Ionian atmosphere of basically sulfur dioxide. So atmospheres form for lens-like rings. The other thing, the only other thing that can form a lens-like ring would be a dome. There's no other natural phenomenon that can create a brilliant ring around both Ganymede and its shadow.
Yeah, it shouldn't be there.
Nope.
Blow it up like a light bulb, you know.
So let's go to number 20. Fortunately, remember I said different cameras and different angles?
Mm-hmm.
A year or so ago, Juno took a photograph of the shadow of Ganymede on Jupiter at its 44,000-mile closest approach. And you can see that in my image number 20. And then 21 is an enlargement of the details of the bright rim, the geometric structure, the sharp boundary between the edge of the glass and the shadow of the moon itself, and the fact that there's enough scattered light at Jupiter's distance, which is 5 times the distance of the sun. The sun out there, if you looked at the surrounding landscape, if you were in a high-powered balloon floating in the cloud tops, the light from the sun would be 25 times dimmer than on Earth, meaning it would be like twilight. So where is all that illuminate? It's the damn dome around Ganymede shining on the clouds of Jupiter with iridescent colors. You can see them in the ring around the dark shadow. And then you've got weird geometries. So is that telling us something about the inner HD physics of Ganymede and Jupiter and the sun? Yes, of course. Anyway, look, we can't go back. We can't unlearn this. So the bet is, how long is it going to take before this new reality goes mainstream?
I can give you a time span, but it just needs to appear on the front cover of one major newspaper. and bang it out there.
So
because
how,
until people...
So go ahead.
It could happen tomorrow. Until, you know, the thing is, people are always looking for an authority to give them permission to accept information or go, oh yeah, they don't even allow themselves to look. So it's an until, you know, a mainstream authority has, you know, the guts to stick it out there. I don't know who's going to do that, Richard. So it's going to take a groundswell of information, you know, from people like yourself, from other media establishments to say, you need to, what is this? We need to take a second look at this stuff. You know, don't have the answer, but we need to put our heads together to see how we can generate the interest, get the knowledge to the general public.
Absolutely. Okay, we are at the bottom of the hour, so let's hold it there. When we come back, we're going to. I want David. David, you're with us, right? Mr. Sarita, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
There you are. Okay. When we come back.
Yeah, my mic was just muted. Yeah, I'm going through all this really slow.
Okay, when we come back, I'm going to have you in real time do a kind of a you know, stream of consciousness. What do you think of what you're seeing? Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts here. I mean, one is the refractive index I want to go through because I think that can rule out atmospheres, because when you see a reflection on a dome that is just white, that would mean it's a solid. It has more solidity to it.
Exactly. Okay. Hold it there. We are literally at the bottom of the hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We're discussing a paradigm shaking breakthrough here. And thanks, Keith. Because once you learn this, you can't go back. One of the ways that I'm going to start the viral wave myself is simply going on all these astronomical websites and asking all these amateurs, because I've got thousands of images. What is that bright ring around the shadow of Jupiter? Or Io? Or Europa? And I'll bet they would never, ever, ever thought of it, because they've all thought, probably because that's the way people think, that if they're assuming it's natural, nobody else is saying anything. It's got to be natural. When we return, David Sarita's expert optical analysis.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com. Thank you.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night. Greeting in the next 30 minutes or so into Monday morning here in the land of Chapman.
I mean, it's mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. How could we all have missed this for all these years? And the only, well, before I get to my ideas for what might explain some of what we're seeing, Mr. Sarita, our optics expert this evening among many, many other areas of expertise, what is your reaction to the unbelievable?
Okay, here we are. So as I'm going through all these images, I'm thinking of refractive index. So a diamond, why a diamond is so bright is it slows the speed of light down in the material more, for example, than even quartz crystal, right? So a diamond has a refractive index of 2.417. Quartz has a refractive index of 1.45 to 46. And then nitrogen, I have the nitrogen, would be a little low, is lower than that. So that means that materials with higher refractive indexes reflect more light, therefore they're bright. These rings of luminosity and what they would be made of, you go to your refractive index, because moons have extremely, like our moon has an extremely faint atmosphere, exosphere.
Oh, but it's brilliant. It's optically 0.000.
I mean, it's so weak that, again, when you're looking, when you look at, for example, a rainbow, and this is just for the common viewer who doesn't know this, what produces a rainbow is when light goes through the hydrogen and the oxygen in the water. The composite colors of white light split into the colors of the rainbow.
Yeah, so because the different frequencies are slowed differently in water.
Right. So that means if you see a pure white ring or mostly white ring, that it's more likely to be something that is more solid than a liquid or gaseous atmosphere. That's because there's...
Well, wait. If we're talking physical domes around the moon and around Ganymede and around Europa, made by this ancient super advanced Arthur C. Clarke third law race, we can't assume anything about its properties. It's certainly not solid. It's obviously compartmentalized. How do we know? Remember the incredible geometry of the dome over the moon photographed by Odysseus. That's the detailed architectural structure when you can get close enough, which the Intuitive Machines robot finally did. And you'll notice they're being deafeningly silent about what their cameras captured.
Well, you know that, like bulletproof glass, for example, aluminum glass would have a very proof, extremely strong, would have a very high refractive index. So therefore, we could speculate. We can't know what it's made of, its chemistry, but we can know, for example, if I looked at a reflection coming off a metallic aircraft, the reflection is going to be mostly the white light coming off of a metallic surface with a little bit of metallic hue to it. And when you look at these rings around the moons, you see something that has more white light than it does refractive coloring, like an atmosphere would have. Like, you know, our atmosphere is nitrogen.
Wait a minute. That's why we need to look at this like a super long focus telescope. Because
right.
when you're in an eclipse on Earth, the angle of the sun and the angle of the moon is half a degree, all right, which is, you know, in a circle of 360 degrees, half a degree is not trivial. But at Jupiter, the angle of the sun that you need to eclipse is one-fifth of 30, of half a degree. So it's like six arc minutes, three arc minutes on each side of a ring. So the light is almost parallel in terms of being bent, refracted, by this 3,000-mile-wide lens, glass ring, circling Ganymede. in this model. And those angles mean that you are not going to see at Jupiter the same kind of refractive color at the edges that you see on Earth, because the angle is so much smaller. All those wavelengths that I show in item number 9, they're basically all landing on each one, so you get white light. So, you know, shadows and eclipses and angles and geometry all changes depending upon how far away you are from the sun. But what doesn't change is the Ganymede shadow is a circle. The Europa shadow is stunningly geometric.
And what makes me, when I think of that, again, if you take a dodecahedron and you, I mean, I sent Keith this a few minutes ago, but and you cast a shadow from a light source that is actually polygonal, like a triangular light source, the shadow looks exactly like what you're seeing in the imagery of the hexagonal shape. Hex is a six-sided, which means that in a higher dimensional reality, what's likely causing it, and I did experiments with this actually in a swimming pool where I was videotaping shadows of counter-rotating water, spinning waters into each other. And imagine the pulses of a negative spin and a positive spin meeting each other, bump against each other. And I was, you know, in this video going frame by frame, I was seeing all the classic geometries being born by counter-rotational pulses.
Yeah, but that's not happening between Europa and Jupiter.
No, I was saying what's in a hyperdimensional model, in a higher dimension, that you think the sun is round and it's casting a shadow and the shadow appears and then you see a hexagonal shape, you have to ask yourself, what is the source that's causing that shape?
Well, it's one of two. It's either the sun itself is not a sphere, even though we see it that way.
Right. That's exactly my point right there.
And my point is, no, that's not true. It's something in Europa is creating a field which is altering the trajectory of the light coming from the sun behind it.
Now remember, nothing, this kind of will trip people out, nothing we see is in the present moment or the future. Everything is in the past. So if you look at a butterfly at the tip of your nose, it's like a trillionth of a second ago. You're looking at the moon, it's a quarter of a second ago. You're looking at the sun, it's 8 minutes and 21 seconds ago. So therefore, everything we photograph and everything we see is in the past, which means it's a hologram. There is no exactly, we don't actually know, when you understand optics and light and the speed of light and how we measure imagery at the speed of light, we don't know the shape of the source because we're only seeing the light reflecting off of it in the past. And the further you get from an object, the more you're seeing it in its past. Its past eventually becomes the future. For example, if I look at the light from the star Vega right now that left Vega like 26 years ago, I'm seeing Vega in its past, but Vega's past is our future.
But why would that change the geometry of a damn shadow?
Well, again, because you look in the fluid dynamic experiment of counter-rotating water vortices when they bump into
each other. What's counter-rotating between Europa and Jupiter or the sun and Europa?
You look at your video of the wave going across the moon. There's always waves bumping into.
No, that's in the dome around the moon. That's not in space between Earth and moon. That's in this shell that's just 20 miles wide.
Go back to the experiment of the shadow of a dodecahedron cast on a two-dimensional plane. It forms a hexagonal or even cubic.
Okay, well, look. Regardless of how this is happening, I think it's happening because of technology. And the reason I think is because some shadows are different than others. Some shadows are normal, circular, except with bright rings, which shouldn't be there. But the two objects are incredibly geometric, both of which have some kind of, in the model, buried a hyperdimensional technology. Or the dome can be activated to change the phasing between dimensions. So we're literally seeing your multi geometric projection from a higher dimension into our dimension, which is
by the sideways, right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, okay. But all right. Regardless of how it's happening, it's not happening for every object looking at every other object, which means it's got to be technology. It's not the intrinsic nature of the sun. It's the portal. Means that Europa and the moon are portals. If you turn them on.
To a hyperdimensional solar system.
Now, all right, let's open up the idea bigger. Why would you do any of this? If, as my model says, this solar system was basically put together with tender, loving care by some super advanced cosmic engineering race to create the 3D, 4D interaction of higher consciousness, we were surrounded by all the clues as to how reality works, including the physics. Then something terrible happened, the war. We lost all that knowledge, and now we're looking at all these clues and not having a glimmer of an idea as to why these things are weird. So some people at some level just shut down, and they decide to ignore all the anomalies.
Well, see, to me, the answer, I mean, this comes from a Gnostic Christian manuscript, a very rare manuscript called The Secret Gospel of John, where in the resurrected form of Christ appearing to the Apostle John, he tells him the story, which is very much a Zechariah Sitchin type story, where these creator gods, demigods and goddesses, fashioned the human organism, the physical part of us, and that when it did that, this supreme being puts this luminous seed in every single human being called the epinoia, which in Greek means light. And we therefore became, with that luminous seed, far more intelligent than our physical co-creators. This is the story in the Apocryphon of John. Jesus is appeared to John in a blaze of light in the desert, and he's showing him this oration of the creation. And because we became more luminous, meaning more intelligent and more actual luminous, the chief of these demigods, whose name is Yaltabaoth and goes under many different names, cast the human race to the lowest region of matter, not a geographical location, the lowest region of matter itself. And then we get trapped there, which is where we are now, and we have to find our way out. So when you look at the idea of a hyperdimensional universe, a hyperdimensional solar system, you don't even have to go to the universe level, just to the myopic solar system level, that would mean the geometries, like look at all those vortices in Jupiter and the poles in Jupiter and Saturn, you see these hexagonals and you go, okay, what's actually the source of that?
Well, it's a quintessential connection to the hyperdimensional reality.
That's exactly it. So we're cast to the lowest region of matter where we don't see any other intelligentsia on the other planets. Of course, we just saw, you know, in spectacular imagery on the Juno mission of Io, which there's a lot of geometries in that imagery. And I understanding camera systems. Okay, so look at Hasselblad that was taken to the moon. Here's the difference between digital photography and film. Black and white photography has three-dimensional crystal, silver crystal halide or bromide on the surface of the gelatin plane of the film, which are three-dimensional, which means they can receive light and refract light three-dimensionally, whereas a digital camera can't do that. It's pure digital imagery using tiny, tiny little pixels and so it's more of the, in a way, there's a bit of a loss. There's something we lost from the old photography of having real crystals that can be reanimated into a two-dimensional image. When you print three-dimensional crystals onto two-dimensional black and white paper, that two-dimensional paper also is made of crystal halide bromide crystals, which are three-dimensional. So your mind, when it looks at those old super high-res photographs, is seeing actually more than it is in the new digital.
No, sorry. No.
Oh, no, it is.
No. David, listen carefully. Black and white images like my number 17 shot on Mount Wilson was a time exposure, you know, maybe a second or two at the focal point of a very large telescope on film, an emulsion, a colloid suspension of silver crystals, all that. And then it was developed. But it has incredibly limited latitude, and it was a you know, multi-second image taken through the scintillating, vibrating atmosphere of the Earth. The modern digital imagery, which you see in 18, taken by an amateur with a 14-inch amateur telescope, not a 60-inch, but on a digital camera, what they do is they record thousands of frames per second. They choose only those where the atmosphere is frozen. They then add them. They register them in a program by many names. There's one called Regitech, meaning you just stack the images. And they get incredible resolutions, which are 10 times better than the world's biggest telescopes taking long, several-second imaging images on film because of the atmosphere. So, no, the model digital imaging and algorithm and technology is light years better than the professor.
I can prove it wrong. But what you would do is you would take, it's true that if you make a print from a silver crystal image today, you in that print, you might not see what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is actually stored in the crystal itself. So if you could extract and super scan those crystals today, you would see way more. But what's happening today, if you used a real Hasselblad digital camera, which would cost you $150,000 on these missions, you would see...
Well, they're going to. Artemis is bragging that Nikon has built a special camera now for the Artemis missions to the moon. So everything you just said is going to be laid out in spades.
Yeah, and guess what else? There's a new pixel reader that can actually multiply the pixels. It's actually an app that is coming out. So we can take these images you have and upscale them 1,000 times. And you'll have, because what I'm saying is the data is there in the old crystals and even in the digital.
Well, but that's all good for the future. What about what we're looking at now?
See,
the biggest question is what was the point? By the way, I did not include tonight because we wouldn't have had time, but I found the same situation at Saturn. Saturn has one large moon, Titan, with an atmosphere of nitrogen, found by Gerard Kuiper back in the 1950s with the telescope in Texas. It's the only known moon with an atmosphere, the only one. It's doing exactly the same thing on the cloud tops of Saturn that Ganymede is doing on the cloud tops of Jupiter. The difference is that the refraction at Titan is coming from the atmosphere, which we can see, and Cassini and Voyager photographed it endless times. And the ring of light from Ganymede, there's no atmosphere, so it's got to be a dome. And the other smaller moons of Saturn, like Tethys and Dione, we've got images, which I will include in future programs, and as part of this new blog, I'm going to start where we go through the details of the research so people can spread the word. These things have artificial glass structures built around them, which raises the profound question, David, what was the end use of all this incredibly advanced technology? And I'll give you two guesses, okay?
Well, why don't we go back to the Apocryphon of John story, which I take literally. I believe there are goddesses who are not interested in our planet. So imagine if you're not interested in Earth at all, its resources, wherever you live, it's got to be a lot better. So that would mean there are so many possibilities to create. Remember, everything we see is a hologram. We don't see anything right now unless you were in quantum time. You would see the real universe. So we're seeing a hologram. And once you understand that you have the ability to manipulate a hologram, you know, that video you in one of your items of the wave going across the moon, you can cause people to see what you don't want them to see when your technology is that advanced by manipulating the hologram, because there's a delay, right? Just like when you watch a sporting game, there's a little delay to edit things out that you don't.
Okay, you're avoiding the question. What are the two possibilities for why physically these structures would be arrayed around most of the moons that we've seen in the solar system, the big ones?
Because there's an intelligentsia there.
No. That's you're getting to the who, not the why or the what. The why is most important. Why would anybody do this?
It would be there's a lot of possibilities for the why. One, just like a LED TV screen, LCD TV screen, I can project the outside of what that planet looks like to the outside observers, but they're not seeing the real planet. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is that it is a protection for beings to live there. And to protect themselves from incoming micrometeorites. There's a lot of reasons.
You know, back when it was all new, okay?
Right, that's back when it was all new.
Well, I'm adding another possibility. If, as is kind of important in my model, this solar system was put together by, you know, kind of like a Chinese menu, one from column A, two from column B, that kind of thing. So we're basically a patchwork of other worlds all brought together in this system to do something. How did all those worlds come together, David? Are we looking in the domes at the technology of literally shepherding the gas giants into the solar system because the moons are really hyperdimensional shepherd moons? And they only see the dome when it's activated, which means it may be in resonance with a cyclic physics, which is coming to a peak now.
Yeah, and the question, you're right. And now with nuclear war being imminent and the gods of, you know, it's interesting. In the last year, I calculated the frequencies of all the planets, including the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and my group of meditators that I work with every Wednesday morning, we've done the frequencies of all the moons you're talking about. And as your brain receives the frequencies based on the wavelength, which is the circumference of those spheres, you start having a connection with that sphere. And you start dreaming and you start experiencing. It starts communicating with you. And we'd be here all night for me to tell you what happened when we did the frequencies of Jupiter's moons and Saturn's moons, and even Neptune and Uranus's a couple of their moons. So all of it is consciousness. All of the human brain wavelengths correspond to the wavelength frequencies of all the planets and definitely all the moons, because moons are generally in the gamma part of the brain. Like they're that's why when you get a full moon, the gamma part of the brain activates and you can't sleep because it's pulling on the gamma wavelength frequencies of the human brain. The human brain is so sensitive that if I give you the frequencies of Io or, you know, Ganymede, or I mean, there's so many of them, Dione, Merope, I mean, there's so many of them, but we work with them for two whole weeks. So if I give you those frequencies for two whole weeks and isolate them, you will have...
Merope, by the way, is a star in the Pleiades. It's not in the Jovian.
Right. Sorry, I know. I lost my mind there. You're right. It's a star in the Pleiades. So I'd have to...
Well, see,
this is, remember our conversation last night. Crystal gave you these numbers, 19.5 backwards.
Right.
And now it turns out that the, you know, time between Robin's death and the December 22nd apparition is one half. In other words, it's all part of the same. Your thought.
We should mention that clearly, because we calculated from March 3rd to December 22nd, Robin's death, March 3rd to the apparition phenomena that happened to you on December 22nd, and it's exactly one orbit one half orbit of 591, accurate to 99.5%. It's phenomenal. Divided by the golden ratio.
Which means it's a harmonic.
Which means it's a harmonic of a hyperdimensional planet.
Yeah.
591 is a
okay. So, I haven't had time to do this comprehensively, but in research I was able to do, I was able to find some years where amateurs were photographing the shadows without rings, and other years when they could see the rings and photograph. Then we get into the digital era, and you get more images of the rings because it's faint. It's not overwhelming. It's subtle. And when you're taking images on film, several second exposures, things blur out. So unless you use the registering technique, you'll never get the incredible imagery that now amateurs are able to do almost routinely, like Damien Peach. I looked at his data. He's got a stunning record, but no one's commenting. And I think it's
go ahead, astronomy cameras that you attach to your Scout telescope are nowhere near the resolution of a Hasselblad or today's new Nikon.
No, but you don't need the resolution.
You would see way more.
Well, you would see detail, but you don't need detail to know that something is there.
No, you don't.
All I'm establishing is thresholds criteria. Is it imaging problems, electronic? Is it film problems? Is it observer problems? I mean, I've got this amazing artistically created image in the 1870s by a brilliant planetary astronomer who was French, but he moved to the United States and he published these lavish coffee table books of astronomical paintings that he'd done. He was much more prolific than Bonstell or Alan Bean. And he shows visually Ganymede with a brilliant ring around it, sitting right in front of Jupiter. So visually, through the telescope, he saw and recorded faithfully the ring. But images taken, a couple of decades later, there's no rings. Is this phenomenon, David, variable? Does it shift with the background physics? Is there a clock? Is there routine maintenance of these domes? So there's time of testing. In other words, is there a whole series of graded phenomena going on that we're not privy to, but the phenomenon is visible sometimes and not visible at others? Is that what
that would indicate a switching on and off? Like,
yeah, exactly.
There are reports, and we had a report here.
Like what we're seeing in the videos.
We have reports.
We got to, bring this to a small halt. My guest this morning, David Sarita. I believe Robert Morningstar is with us. Ron Gervron was going to join. And Ruggiero is still with us. You're on the other side of midnight. When we return, all of those voices and perspectives. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't touch that button. I know it's not a dial. It's a button. Don't touch it.
Other side of midnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio with pictures on demand. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, now Monday morning, here in the Land of Enchantment, the Witching Hour after midnight. My guest this morning, David Sarita, Ruggiero Kahlo is still with us. I don't know whether Ron is with us, and Andrew and Robert Morningstar. They were all going to join, but I think we have a hiccup. So, David, please continue.
I'm here, Richard. So you got the, I just wanted to bring up this one point before you go on to probably Robert, but the UAPs and their transmedium ability to go through very dense water at unimaginable speeds and then even through solid material would mean, like, for example, a mountain goes straight into a mountain, an actual material craft goes straight into a mountain and not even a sound or a shock wave in response. So when you think of a glass or some type of a materialistic dome that is possibly switching on and switching off, the UAP itself might have a wave mechanism to switch on and switch off the resistance factor to permeability through medium, meaning even solid medium, liquid medium. And obviously, we have a hard time even going through atmospheric medium because of drag and resistance on the wings and the structure of a craft. So once you get over that idea, the idea of a dome being permeable to incoming craft that are operated by super intelligentsia becomes
if you're talking about a dome when it was brand new, it was capable of phasing,
right,
and dephasing,
right,
and interacting with material. Yeah, all that is super technology. I'm talking about what it's doing now. So supposedly,
what it's doing now, Richard, if it's switching on and switching off, then that would indicate, because if it's not consistent, if it's not always observable consistently as a natural, sustainable structure, these domes.
Look at number 14. Just look at my number 14. I think it's
14.
No. Hang on. Got it wrong. Oh, where is? Oh, no, number 19. Sorry. 19.
So you're 19. Yeah.
Look at that.
I know.
That changes everything.
It changes everything, which means that, again, remember, everything's a hologram.
In your model, not in mine, please.
No, I mean, visually, everything is hologram.
No, it's not. If it were, we couldn't figure out the universe.
You're not seeing Jupiter right now.
Doesn't matter. We're not seeing Alpha Centauri for 4.3 years. Who cares? It's the same data.
You're not even seeing. I know you're seeing Jupiter in the past in these images because of the speed of light. It's like, what is it, 4 hours away from us about?
No. It's about half an hour. It's half a billion miles, so it's about an hour and a half.
Okay, so about, depending on its orbital position, so an hour and a half away. So when you have a telescope or you have a flyby, because this is a flyby, so the flyby would mean it's seeing it closer into real time, right? So there.
Why does the time matter, David?
Matters because if it's a controlled technological hologram, it can be changed in that time delay by a very advanced civilization. They can change what we see, just like with
that. Well, again, that is your model. That's your projection. I don't know that's reality. To me, if this is an ancient technology which has been maintained by some AI, and it's supposed to, at regular intervals, something like maybe 26,000 years, do something to the solar system. Maybe it's the mechanism for uplifting in frequency everything we talked about last night in the lower into the upper.
So think of a bridge. Think of a bridge. The bridge is between worlds and dimensions.
Why do you think in my ancestors' ancient tales, the Vikings, we have the Midgard and the Bifrost Bridge?
It's all
about the physics and dimensions. So
one of the things
I want to look for, as I said this last night, if the eclipse is so dangerous that NASA at all costs, not telling even its own astronauts, will not let them fly through a total eclipse because of the disastrous effects the physics will have on the technology of the space station and or spacecraft, and they haven't told them, then that technology either is natural and is activated by the fact that we're at the 26,000-year interval, or someone has been testing it prior to the eclipse, and if it was activated during the eclipse on the 8th, remember, when the eclipse was literally at 19.47 degrees from the equinoctial point in Aries in March, then I want to look at the death and birth statistics for the cities all along that eclipse track. Because maybe...
Well, look at the... Remember the piece I sent you, which was on space weather, of the lost time that was recorded in...
Yeah, and I sent you my graph showing exactly the same thing.
Right.
Because we're not measuring time. We're measuring frequency, which is interpolated as time in non-relativity. In Newtonian physics, you know, time is supposed to be simultaneous. In relativity, it's not. Well, this looks like it's another variant on time. Does time make a difference?
Right. Did we have a time dilation? We know we did during the eclipse because it was recorded.
So then the question is, are these changes in the dome all designed to have changes in the consciousness of beings who were under those domes or exposed to those domes in a regular hyperdimensional cyclic solar system?
So that's what I'm saying. I'm seeing the domes, like imagine if I had a super huge plasma TV and you were on Mars and you had a telescope that zoomed all the way into Earth and you can see this plasma the screen TV and it's showing a football game. But that's not what's really happening on the Earth. There is no football game going on. It's just showing you a movie. And you say, oh, that's what they're doing down there because I can see on this plasma display through my telescope that this is what they're doing, but they're not doing that. So what if these domes are actually a technology?
Yes, we're all saying the same thing. Robert.
Right.
You've obviously got some thoughts. What do you think?
You might have passed out.
Robert? Mr. Morningside?
He was there a minute ago.
Yeah, I know. I heard his voice, and then he...
Yes, I was...
There you are. Okay.
I'm here. Hi.
And, well, hang on. Hang on, Robert, first.
Just say... I'm not sure. Hang on. I'll tell you, I'm here.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so Holger, I'm fascinated by your eclipse video. I thought that it was the best I've ever seen. Also, I ask you a question. I know you heard the sonic boom. There were two waves of oscillating sounds about a minute and a half before that. Did you hear those, or were those just picked up by the video? They were like,
Robert, yeah, good observation. The video itself is original sound, but I had to filter out our background voice a bit because we were talking in the background.
Yeah, that's a legitimate.
I, I yeah. filtered that out, and the filtering out added this bass sound, this wobbling sound in the background.
Oh,
this is a filtering effect.
I have an answer to your question about what caused sound.
Yeah, that's the wobbling kind of low sound. That is a filter effect of
the
voice, distorted voice, which still went through the filter a bit.
Well, the sonic boom is important. And I don't know if people on the show know it, but I was certified a weather specialist by the Department of Homeland Security in 2004, and I've always studied weather. Now, that sound is very intense. Sonic boom is the right word for it. Now, I have a theory that it was caused by the supercooling of the atmosphere in a column in the shadow of the moon. And that super cooling of the atmosphere, the temperature drops so quickly that, and you are in Arkansas, that it created thunder between the column of shadow and the open sky as the moon was moving. Now, I'll tell you this. In 2017, August 21st, when we had that first eclipse, I went out with my video camera here in New York City to videotape the eclipse. And I've had a stunning experience. I was out on Broadway and 92nd Street looking at the eclipse happening through a hazy sky. And in my hand, I had a high-resolution video camera with a flip screen. So you just hold it and you look in the screen. I looked at the eclipse about halfway through and coming through haze. It was not totally overcast, but like a haze all the way down. I looked into the screen and the shadow of the moon was descending on the earth, and it looked like a column of black smoke descending from the moon's shadow, passing through the atmosphere. The camera could see the shadow of the moon in the haze, but my eyes couldn't see it. So that is a visual image that I want you to take and realize that that whole column, the shadow, the smoke shadow of the moon was cooling so rapidly at high atmosphere that it created two air masses. Thunder is created when a hot air mass meets a warm air mass, a cold air mass. Those are actually cells.
Yeah, but you don't get, those things are not shockwaves because they're in the atmosphere. They're the atmosphere itself. It's not perturbed to move as a physical object, like the wing of an airplane moving supersonically.
By the way, you mentioned the passage of two RB-47s and assumed they were supersonic. RB-47's top speed is 660 miles an hour. They couldn't go supersonic. So I got that clear up. I wanted to mention that.
So what is the speed of sound at altitude, 40,000 feet? It's right at the boundary.
That's not less than level.
Here it's at about 780 miles an hour sea level. So that's why they want to do the breaking of sound barriers higher up. It's a little bit less.
But that doesn't really matter.
I wanted your big vision. What do you think of the big model and the damn data?
Well, the big model, I don't agree completely with all your interpretations of the images. For example, in the image 14, we're just talking about the shadow of Europa.
Hang on. Let me go back.
Yeah, that's confusing. The one with Jupiter. Yeah, Europa.
Yeah, look at 13. That's together. The shadow is just to the left of the great red spot, which is a bright white circle because this is infrared. So it's the clouds over the bright red spot are brilliantly illuminating in infrared, so they glow bright white. And then the object on the right in 13 is simply the shadow of Europa, which is the object in the middle of the, with the dark dot in the middle of the bright white. That's an optical digital inversion effect of too bright. It goes black as opposed to, it can't exceed the threshold of the camera. So
yeah,
and then number 15.
Hold on a second. This juxtaposition of these two pictures is a little confusing. Is the left one saying that the little ring of light on the left side, the eclipse caused by Europa? What is that? Is that
number 13 is Jupiter.
I'm talking about 14.
Okay, 14 is the Earth, which is the north pole of the Earth, and eclipse with the same geometry as the shadow on Europa.
Right. So it's 13, the one I was saying is confusing. Are we to take that small ring of light on the far left to be the eclipse?
No. That is Europa. That's an overexposed image of the moon itself in the Webb telescope, in the infrared. And with some, this was an engineering image. It wasn't finely tuned. And what happened is because of the under digital voltage, the center of Europa, which is brilliant white, it's ice, okay? It reflects enough infrared that it went dark. It's just a processing thing in the camera.
Okay.
The shadow of Europa is the little dark speck to the left of the great white spot on the surface
of
Jupiter.
Yes, I know. I'm familiar with that one.
And then the right side is the close-up of the shadow. And then 14 is the Earth shadow of the Earth moon during eclipse. And then 15 is both together showing the same damn geometry.
Yeah. Well, my interpretation of the distortion has to do with the hundreds of miles of atmosphere and clouds that are over Jupiter.
No.
Oh, yes.
Robert,
yes,
no. No. When you say something scientifically dumb, I will call you on it. Would you stop talking over me? I will cut you off if you talk over me.
Come on.
I am showing you absolutely unbelievable data, and you're picking nitpicks in it. Wrong physics.
He's looking through the shadow of a very cloudy atmosphere descending into a planet where the solidity of the planet is nowhere to be seen. So you're seeing the shadow in diffusion.
No, you're not. Because if it was diffusion, it would be a circle, diffuse circle. It would not be a geometry. It would not be a hexagon, foreshortened. That geometry, which is identical to the Earth eclipse, which neither one should exist, is a profound mystery. Don't trivialize it. Try to figure it out.
That's the gravitational effect of Jupiter's mass and gravity. It could be distorting.
Show me numbers. Show me a model. That's why I have David, because he's an optician. And David, this is not atmosphere. This is projection on the cloud tops that are literally below the resolution of the camera. So you're not seeing any optical depth. It's a
Richard, look at 14. Look at the clouds. They're also angular. There's a vortex of clouds.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
you see the square angle of those cloud structures in the vortex?
Because the vortices are rotating. The physics interacts with rotating systems. The clouds have mass. They're attracted by the physics into unusual shapes. I looked at those after I looked at the shadow. Kinds of HD effects going on that nobody's talking about.
Well, I'm talking about it as a gravitational lens.
It's not gravitational. It's not gravitation.
Well,
do the numbers.
There's a distorted cloud.
Hello? Okay, Ron. Sorry. Decades ago, you claimed in
nobody apologized. Gravity matters. I feel like I'm listening to a gardening show. I'm like, oh, look, a crashed flying saucer.
Rob, this is not gravity. The numbers. There is no gravitational lensing going on, period, under any current model.
Lensing? No. Wait. But because that's within our parameters of physics. But we're talking like something more like what would be on the quantum level. And there is an interaction between the gravity fields everywhere.
Gravity fields and electromagnetic fields. But I want to touch on why the space station didn't fly under the shadow. Hold on. The space station, again, didn't fly under the shadow, I believe, because it would have been damaged from two things. Supercooling, but gravitational forces when you have the summation of the sun's gravitational line along with the moon's, and you know what the moon does to the tides alone, they're tremendous effects. And as I predicted, there are earthquakes on the opposite side of the earth within 48 hours, they did unfold. So I believe that the space station could have been damaged. Gyroscopes could have been thrown out of kilter. And their caution is the greater part of valor, I would say. So, and probably the astronauts in 1963 with the Gemini, we were talking about Gemini 3, they probably, well, Gemini 12. Gemini 12. I thought you said 3 earlier.
No.
Anyway, 1, 2, 3. But anyway, the point is that the temperature drop in outer space, especially of passing
shadow. It's not even noticeable, Robert. You do the numbers. What you're saying is not real. It's not real. It's the hyperdimensional effects because first Gemini interaction. NASA never allowed another manned spacecraft to ever enter the shadow. And look at my graph. Look at number.
But they didn't tell you why.
Look at number. Okay. I think it's 20.
You'll have her.
I think it's 20. Hang on a second. I'll find it all. Number 24. Look at 24. Those are real inertial changes when you enter the eclipse. That's real data.
Yeah.
Then you magnify every rotating mechanical system in a space station the size of, you know, a football field. And you're absolutely right. They could not predict the effect, so they avoided it, which is very good.
Yeah. Sure.
But they advertised they weren't going to avoid it. That, oh, we missed it by accident. There are no accidents in celestial mechanics.
You know, Richard, they lie so much, they could probably have flown through it and are telling us they didn't. You know, never a straight answer.
Well, hang on a second. You raised another interesting point.
True.
Hang on. Suppose, like with the Accutron, number 24, the physics in the shadow so changed the trajectory of ISIS, literally in orbit, that it caused them to avoid through some kind of repulsion balance.
Yes.
The
yes.
shadow. And there, and see, that's the other, that's actually even more likely than they deliberately avoided it, because it's like they had to come up with an excuse afterwards, and they came up with a dumb excuse, because anybody who knows anything about orbits know you can predict the orbit of the space station certainly a week in advance.
Well, Holger did mention the decrease in the electron density, and I think that so that is something to consider. That would have a very powerful magnetic effect. And not an
electromagnetic but it wouldn't
effect.
Be close enough for it to, unless you go right through the shadow, and then it's like 13 seconds. No, it actually, given the fact that on live television, the astronauts in the space station during the NASA broadcast were advertising they were anticipating seeing, looking up at the eclipse and photographing it, as well as looking down and photographing the shadow, and they showed all the cameras, and one of the astronauts was a really, you know, photography pro, and he was explaining in great detail how he was going to capture this amazing phenomenon, and then they miss it? No. Something unusual happened when they went through it, and they don't want to talk about it.
Could be. Or they went through it, took their pictures, and they'll want to show it to us for another 15 years or so. Just you know how they are. Come on.
Yeah.
They make up stories all the
okay,
time.
Okay. We've got about 5 minutes to the bottom of the hour, and then I want to talk about Ron's. I want to talk about Ron's discovery.
Oh, dear.
I wanted to talk about the instability period and the theory that Jupiter had something to do with the formation of the moon. I sent you the science article.
I'm aware of all that in the modeling. It's all modeling. They don't know anything. It's all moving things around in a computer. And if your theory of gravity is wrong, there goes your model.
Yeah.
If your theory of inertia and gravity are wrong, and your shadows from round objects turn out to be, you know, compressed dodecahedrons, there goes your model. This is not a trivial discovery, gentlemen.
Okay, when we come back, I do want to get the chance to go through a couple of my items, because I've got some important things in. Okay?
Well, let's do this. Let's come back with Ron, and then we'll go back to you. Because Ron has a claim to fame when it comes to domes around Jupiter. Do you want to tease, okay, Ron?
I just did, yes. I've been thinking about them as long as Richard has, or longer, but I have some different conclusions about parts of it.
Well, look at number 19.
Okay.
Number 19, look, you understand that number 19 shouldn't exist? My number 19, yeah. Side by side, the original Cassini data, and then I did a gentle enhancement and a saturation run, and there's the dome. Now, what do you think the odds are of Cassini going by Jupiter on an afternoon at the right angle to catch Ganymede between it and Jupiter at the right angle to the sun to image all of Jupiter in the ring, the shadow, the lighting, the enhancement, every aspect of that picture is posed, which means NASA wanted to capture the dome from Cassini flying by at that moment. It's not an accident. Okay. We are at the...
What, on org number 19?
Number 19.
What is in the next?
The photograph.
Yes.
Itself. Look at the photograph. And we are basically we're at the bottom of the hour. So let me do something quick here. Okay, I have to do something. Okay, here we are. That's not working. I have a switch that's not working. Ah, terrible, terrible. That's it. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. 1.5 hour to go. Don't touch that dial.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. I had some switch problems there with the computer. Solved them. Thank you. So, Ron, several years ago, and I had a kind of a random conversation, and I brought up the idea of a dome around Ganymede, which I had found, I believed, by comparing the comparative colors of the glass and the refraction and the prismatic effects and all that. And he said to me, well, I've kind of known about this for quite a while. So, Ron, tell us a story, please.
Yeah, exactly. When I first came across some of the pictures of Jupiter and its moons, I got caught up in, you know, it was really, they were really, there were so many of them, and they were so pretty. This was great stuff. I think there was one of those pictures hanging on the wall at the conference where Richard and I first bumped into each other. In fact, so that was before we were talking about this all, but they had one of those pictures from Voyager, I guess.
Yeah, Ron escaped with minor injuries from our colliding with each other.
Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, well, we discussed the moon. So therefore, I did mention that. Anyway, the thing is, when I got a chance to look at images years later, explanation for it, and I had been dealing with the fact that virtually all of those pictures that they've taken, as beautiful as they are, and as I just reminisced, they're fuzzy, all of them. I mean, you can make something fuzzy and blur something up, and it still has nice sharp edges. Relatively, you know, you think so as a viewer. But they all needed to be sharpened up and cleaned up one way or another. So when I did that, boom, it looks like glass. You look closer, and there's big holes in a couple of spots that look like the bullet holes a gangster puts in a car window. You know, it looked like something had hit something very, very substantial. So unless during an ancient war, the ones that were attacking were trying to shrink wrap their enemies on a planetary scale, there was some sort of glass there that got hit by a meteor or probably an asteroid, but possibly a bolt from some force of weapon. Doesn't matter. That's what it looked like. And I said, they put a dome around the whole moon. So then I spent ages just occasionally musing on why would somebody put a dome around something. Yeah. Only thing I could think of. But
Do you remember that old Robert Heinlein's short? No, it was a novel called Farmer in the Sky.
And they're terraforming and farming on
Ganymede. Yes. What did Robert know, and when did he know it?
Yeah, that was why I was looking at the pictures of Ganymede for one thing.
You know, I have to go look, and I haven't. I wish Andrew was with us. I have to go look at some of the Bonstell originals because Robert Heinlein and Chesley Bonstell were friends. They knew each other really well because Chesley illustrated Robert's movie Destination Moon with all those amazing sets of the spaceship on the moon. And Chesley Bonstell had access to Mount Wilson and would go up there regularly and use the big telescopes and would paint the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And I have to go back now and I have to look at his paintings to see, did Chesley, in those years, did we know when he did this, did he paint, which if he'd seen that, he would have, energized domes around Ganymede and in the Saturn system, or were those the years when the architecture was quiescent, the domes were not energized, and the light was not altered?
No, we don't know why they did. Ganymede's the only one that looks like somebody might have been living there.
Well, look at number 19. I love number 19. That's exquisite proof. There's no any NASA model of Ganymede that can explain what you see in image 19. None. Zero. And I want anybody who feels they can come up with a numerical model, please send it to me. Show it to me. you know, the contact email on the Enterprise website, on the Other Side of Midnight website. Send me a model that makes sense of why this is not a physical glass-like. Notice I use the term glass-like, because I don't think this is your grandmother's glass. I think this is an incredibly high-tech radiation alloy of some super AT material, which can be energized selectively and which can create, I mean, imagine having a telescope literally with a lens which is 3,000 miles across. If you position unmanned spacecraft with cameras at the right distance from these objects, the lens effect will bring the light to a focus at a point literally the size of a human technological space camera. And you could use these telescopes to photograph the details of planetary systems thousands of light years away, and you could see their continents, their polar caps, their clouds. I mean, the level of technology we're looking at, it's not a theory, look at the damn pictures, is staggering by our current technological extrapolations. And we're in the middle of it. We are living in a designer solar system. Why, when, who, and are they coming back?
Well, if they are, we can read the duty roster through a window, one of the battlecraft ended our way 1,000 light years away.
You mean with one of these telescopes?
Yes,
yeah, but you'd have to know the right position. That was kind of a theoretical, you know, a mind experiment. But yeah,
I've been trying to think of who was it proposed doing it to the entire solar system, and at that level, you could read the calendar on the refrigerator of a kitchen.
Yeah, and apropos of David and his holographic time model, every image we would see would be removed in time by the speed of light from whatever objects we were looking at. So in terms of, I mean, you literally probably see planets now in over in Andromeda with telescopes of this size. And all you have to do, NASA, hint, hint, send an unmanned spacecraft to the focal point of every one of these domes, and you can look 360 at anything you want to with a telescope which is 3,000 miles across. And then if that's not big enough, what, Ron, if would happen if you gang two of them together?
Yeah.
What if you use the moon dome as one telescope and then a half a billion miles away, use the one around Europa, and you look at the same patch of sky, but you've got two telescopes which are millions, you know, half a billion miles apart, 3,000 miles across, give or take, 2, 3. I mean, the contemporary technological use of what we're seeing out there by our own civilization is mind-boggling.
Even by the...
Go ahead.
It would take one heck of an algorithm to keep the all of those in sync. I was visualizing several sites in the solar system while you were saying that, and it's like, okay, and put one there, and then that would have factors in.
Well,
and,
given the rate of
advance, all those in sync, even the timelines would still be a,
given the rate of advance of AI, I would say in the next 10 or 20 years, we would be algorithmically capable of doing this. Technologically, with a spacecraft with cameras put at the focal point, that's relatively simple. But Ron is right. It's interpreting the image computer, which is going to be the art form, and it can be done. You can deconvolve anything if you've got enough information, and boy, do we have enough information with these objects now.
Well, you need a metric. I mean, I just read something about in the last day or so about a problem with the gravity field overall of the entire galaxy and maybe the entire universe. It's if they keep the idea that the universe is expanding, then this is like a hysteresis, or it's weird. It's a stretching effect to time, which is why they can't measure it the way that Einstein general theory of relativity that they lean on for this.
So we're basically nudging up again new physics.
Yeah, it has to be something else. And you say hyperdimensional physics, that can't include any of the stuff, any of the measuring rods that we're used to.
If there are unknown effects operating on those measuring rods, like, you know, the light curves of supernovae or the variable mm-hmm. light curves of Cepheids in various distant galaxies, which do not match other derivations of the so-called Hubble expansion curve, we're obviously missing something. But in our own backyard, to have missed something for so long, I wish, and I just need more time to do this, I'm going to make a compilation of
graphite equation.
I'm concerned.
Yeah, you have to translate from one metric to another. I mean, just visualize something yourself right now between you and Keith. Keith is the god of communication wiring and board adjustments. And so he, using this feature tech, he projects right onto your table there a great big knob for doing some obscure function that you have to do.
Okay.
And he's ready. He puts it there. And it's just like projecting something from a, you know, some sort of matter transmitter. Except it's not really there. It's simply tuned in to where you are. Then you can reach out and physically turn the knob. But if it's not in tune...
Well, you're basically talking about a holodeck.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
What I'm trying to say, lay out in terms of new data tonight, which will mark this show as one we'll replay because it's important and you'll miss details unless you listen to it a couple, three times. We are living in a designed hyperdimensional solar system for some end, some goal, some purpose, some creators. I would like to begin tonight to try to figure out what the hell we're doing here. Given all that the mainstream observations are all wrong. Correct.
Intentionally wrong.
Yeah, the suppressed.
Don't forget that part.
It has to be suppressed.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think we're coming to the end of the embargo. So many areas and avenues of exploration. I mean, look, we can test the interstellar telescope moon dome model with a private CubeSat. A private company, a private billionaire, a private millionaire could launch his own exploration of the astronomical properties of the dome around the moon, could publish them on Twitter or X, and the guy to do that could be Musk. We are at the threshold of stunning changes and just in time, because look at what was flying and taking down missiles over Israel the other night. That is not a known terrestrial technology. Either that's super tech Israel, or they had help.
Hey, Richard, we're running out of time. We got 15 minutes. I'd like to go through my...
You are on. Go for it.
You mentioned coming to the end of the embargo, and a big part of it right now, of course, the end of the embargo is not just scientific, it's political. And Robert Kennedy Jr. has been very vocally saying that the CIA killed his uncle and I know that it was his father as well, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the attempt on Reagan. All of these were in-house operations. In coming weeks, I'm going to be revealing how a...
Well, hang on. Before you leave that subject, why?
Yeah.
Why was Kennedy killed?
Well, that's the point in this movie, Cosmic Betrayal. I want to point people, pay attention. Cosmic Betrayal, I'm trying to get it released for John F. Kennedy's birthday, May 29th. But the gist of it is the CIA was taken over by a political party in 1950. And I've been breaking that story slowly over the last couple of weeks, that the New World Order was a book written by H.G. Wells in 1938, and it gave birth to a lot of political parties advocating New World Order. One of them in America was the World Federalist Party. And then there was an offshoot called the United World Federalist Party, and its presidential candidate was none other than Cord Meyer. Now, both of these were very leftist organizations, one leftist communist and the other one leftist fascist, in the sense of communism. So I think that's right. That's not left. That's right. Radical right.
Okay.
Cord Meyer, they meet in a circle, you know. Yes, they do. That's right. It's two sides of the same coin, and the third side of the coin is the edge. So Cord Meyer was a man who would be president of the United States. He was the presidential candidate of the United World Federalist Party, which was heavily backed by Rockefeller. Doors were open to Cord Meyer to interview and be interviewed with luminaries, meetings with Einstein and other high-ranking scientists. The World Federalist Party, the United World Federalist Party, didn't go very far because Americans didn't want to go in that direction. And in 1950, Alan Dulles recruited Cord Meyer to become a member of the CIA. And he wound up being in charge of the MKUltra mind control program. So when he went into the CIA,
which
used LSD and other...
Oh, yes.
I have nothing against LSD. I do have against programming killers and zombies, you know? So anyway, that's the story.
They had people walk out of 14-story windows because they didn't know they were, you know, in this...
With assistance, no, they threw, Frank Olson was thrown out of the Hotel Pennsylvania because he knew too much about the experiments and he thought they were unethical. And that's
what does this have to do with domes around the moons of the solar system?
Kennedy probably knew about architecture on the moon and he was going to...
Hang on. Do you know why? Do you know how?
Probably.
Do you know how?
Oh, your Project Corona.
Exactly. Exactly.
So anyway, this
is not a mystery because he changed from being a really radical right guy, you know, the Soviet Empire over my dead body, to wanting to propose to Khrushchev that we all go together. The one thing that made the difference was he saw what there was there waiting for humankind, and they murdered him for it.
But he also knew about the contract and the contact between the U.S. government, the secret government, and the aliens. So I'm going to be giving a series called the MJ-13 Global UFO Webinar. I'd like people to take a look at this interview I did with Michael Sala. It was one of the best interviews that I've ever given. And also, I want you to pay attention.
He must have been having a good night.
Oh, yeah, the final analysis on the hoax JFK x-rays with Dr. David Mantic, PhD. He's the author of the final analysis on the JFK assassination, and he is the world's, well, I consider him America's foremost expert on radiology and the JFK assassination. And he's proven through radiology and studies of optical density of the x-rays, if they were all hoax, they're manipulated. The bone thickness is twice as thick as any human being could possibly have. So you'll get a lot of information out of the final analysis. And I want to thank Buzz Aldrin for releasing that leak of lunar debris, the crash photo. It's going on. 8,000 people have read this article. And Buzz Aldrin leaked something really important and very quietly by putting that picture out on his Twitter account, an autographed picture. Since that time, I found three more pictures.
Wait, which picture is that, Robert? Excuse me, I'm getting...
That's the one that we talked about.
Lunar Cave. Remember the one that shows Lunar Cave, the crash?
Oh, that. Okay, the Apollo. The Apollo.
Yeah, the Apollo. Apollo 11 picture.
Yeah.
So a more picture.
Yeah, I was picturing Randy on the floor of his office in Roswell holding a paper form. So I just, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Robert,
well,
these pictures to me.
Right.
Go ahead.
The Aldrin pictures are in that link. I enhanced them, I enlarged them.
Again, Robert, you didn't tell me you wanted to do a commercial. Talk about the domes around the moon. The least
well,
you can do is respect the fellow colleague's discoveries.
Okay, I do believe that there are domes on the moon. I believe that they are over craters. I don't believe in the Saran Wrap moon.
See, science is not belief. It's data. The data says you're wrong.
No, but it's not faith either.
Show me how my model is wrong and what's there is explainable by some other physical effect.
So you keep saying that this the remains of this dome has set a super tested. As thin as cigarette smoke, and that it's knocking down a landing spacecraft. You know, I say,
obviously you haven't listened carefully. The overall average density is cigarette smoke. There are areas of heavy mass still suspended, and if you hit one of those, it's toast.
Yes, I agree. I think
so you're saying that. But if you look in an abandoned warehouse with a bunch of broken windows on the side, then you have to factor in the fact that some of them are solid and some are not. You come up with an average density for the windows on the side of the broken building.
That's basically
a stretch.
It's all just numbers and observation and good cameras. That's all.
They're either there or they're not.
No, they're not. They're there to a degree of density. It's mass and optical depth, meaning looking through thousands of miles of this stuff. If you're standing right next to it, you wouldn't see it. But 1,000 miles away, of course you're going to see it because the optical density adds.
Ron, that metaphor is not what I am saying. I'm saying that there are partially collapsed domes, that there are structures on the moon that are made of glass. I don't feel that they're all contiguous and continuous. So I don't believe in the Saran Wrap moon, but I believe...
See, belief has nothing to do with science. It's not belief. It's data.
Sure. You're in a caucus race. You're saying the same thing over again. Yeah, Robert, I understand. You weren't saying that it was diaphanous little domes on the moon. You're just saying that, which I tend to agree with the concept, that they would localize it. There would be a habitat dome, another habitat dome.
I believe in those. But I also believe that there's a sheath, a giant sheath of glass that was cast over the far side of the moon when the asteroid that created the Mare Orientale threw out billions of tons of glass that were molten.
Okay, moving from our own moon, what about the outer solar?
The Chinese are about to move there in 36 hours.
Wait, guys, listen. I just got a report from the South China Morning Post. Chinese newspaper, that the Chinese are perfecting laser propulsion for their submarines.
Oh, I've seen that story. It doesn't work.
Yeah, well, we don't know.
Well, yes, we do. The numbers are all wrong.
You are actually a presumptuous person. You know?
No, I'm not. I do science by the numbers.
Forget the numbers.
You can't forget the numbers.
Get a pot of hot water.
Stick with the numbers. You're stuck with one metric.
A submarine.
Yeah. Guys aren't thinking dimensions.
This is
a very far diversion. Exhaust pipe. Fill it with water on the back of a submarine. Superheat that water with a laser, and you will have laser propulsion, steam-driven, with an infinite source of fuel in the ocean water itself. Okay? It's as simple as that.
It still can't go any faster than... the current technology, because the limit is the speed of the shock waves in the water on the vessel.
Now, that's not true. USOs prove that they can move at 8,000 miles an hour underwater. So
we don't have their ET technology. So it's 56 minutes till the hour. It's 56 minutes after the hour. We've got literally 2 minutes. David, some final thoughts.
Yes. Why can we accept set a Dyson sphere, which is a hypothetical megastructure that encompasses an entire star. And this is a feasible theory headed by Freeman Dyson. He's the first scientist to explore the concept. We can accept that, but we can't accept a megastructure surrounding a moon, which is a tiny fraction.
I'm so baffled, David. The two very bright genius level guys cannot accept what's obvious in the data. The solar system has
glowed. The data shows a consistent illumination with a high degree of refractive index material. That's the data. So why is the Dyson sphere so acceptable today, which is far in advance of what Richard's talking about? And Richard, you brought up something amazing that triggered something in me. What if this dome around the moon is actually operating as a holographic lens to collect data of an enormous size, because your dish is the
yes, and transmit it over millions of light years at warp velocities. In other words,
if we can accept a Dyson sphere, we can accept that.
See, the coolest part is we don't have to wonder. In a few years, Elon Musk is going to land with a whole bunch of non-deep state astronauts, and they're going to cover this whole thing, and we'll have data up the wazoo, because it can't be hidden more than a couple more years. Maybe even not that long. And we literally have 30 seconds.
And what are we going to do with the knowledge of how to a dome around the moon that takes probably hundreds of years to go?
No, well, has it not with AI, with nanobots?
Okay, so they got robots. It still takes physical.
No, not robots.
Material.
Nanobots. Tiny, tiny.
Okay. They still have to get resources.
Guys.
Well, we
we've run out of runway. I want to thank all my guests this evening, Ron and Robert Morningstar, David Sarita, Ruggiero Kahlo. Brilliant confirmation and discussion and a lot of controversy. So we're going to continue doing this. We'll have new data shortly. And then, guess what? We go back to the moon. Hey, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.